I'd like now, for the minutes that remain, to explain to you a little of the work that God is doing in our area. We live in Southern California, Los Angeles. We have a work in Mexico, in the place called Baja California. It's in the peninsula of Mexico. It's about 7 hours from our home. We try to go there. At first, we were going there every other week, twice a month, and now we have limited down to approximately once a month due to the other demands upon us. It started in 1980. We were meeting in the home of some Christians. We started with a nucleus of believers and needing to and desiring to know the truth of God about assembly gathering. Our first series of meetings was taken in the month of July, and if you were ever been in the Imperial Valley in the month of July, they'll give you a very, very warm welcome there. In fact, I'm sorry, I don't know this, I only know this in Fahrenheit, but 120 degrees is what it often is over there in the shade in the summertime, and that's the kind of weather we were dealing with at that time. We started our meetings approximately at 7 o'clock in the evening, and at times it would go on until after midnight. Such was the appetite and the desire on the part of these people to hear and to know God's word about the gathering place. That wasn't so bad for me because I was able to stand and I was able to conduct the Bible study in that way. But it wasn't so comfortable for my wife and children because the only seating accommodations were some little logs about yay so and stuck them across on buckets, and that's where they had to sit for those many hours, night after night. So anyway, that was how, as far as we were concerned, the work in Mexico began. It began with a nucleus of about 10 believers. Today, there are over 25 that are in the Assembly Fellowship. God has richly blessed, especially in the last couple of years. We have had the joy of being at numerous baptisms, and just recently, before we came away, we had a baptism of a man. He, due to gangrene, he has lost one of his legs, and possibly, well, the other leg may be amputated in time to come due to the illness that he has. And he was really exercised about being baptized while he still had his one leg. And that was quite a novelty. We never had quite a thing like that before, but we had the joy of seeing that brother baptized, and he was just exuberant. He was just so happy in the joy of following the Lord and obeying Him in baptism. He has now been received into the Assembly Fellowship, and there has been a number of other young men, I would say about five of them, who have recently been baptized in the last year or two, and very good contributors to the assembly there with a great exercise. We had a wedding this past year, the first wedding in the hall. It was a wonderful occasion, and the Lord blessed. From that wedding and the testimony of it all, there have been two that have professed to be saved, and two that professed were the mother and the father of the groom. So it was a great time of rejoicing, and it has also opened up a real interest in the hearts of others who have never seen a Christian wedding before. Actually, the believers themselves have never seen a Christian wedding, and they came to my wife one day. We were visiting, and the lady who was going to be married, she says to her, she says, "I'm going to be married in 2 weeks. I don't know anything about a Christian wedding. Can you help me?" My wife says, "Well, you have no idea what you're asking, but we will do the best we can." We went home and spent many, many hours preparing for the wedding and came back the next week, had a little rehearsal and preparing the last minute things, went home again, long hours and getting everything ready. And it happened to be that Friday night we went back to Mexico. Was a baby shower for another group of people that we're working with in an outreach work. So we had to go to the baby shower and got out of there about 11:30, 12 o'clock. Then we had to drive all the way to the border, and we spent the night at the border. We got in there about 4:30, up again at 6:30, went over there for the wedding, and had the wedding. It was a wonderful occasion. Afterwards, the brethren said, well, we're all here, and this is a wonderful time. Why don't we have a Bible study? So we had a four-hour Bible study in the afternoon, and they thought that was great. Now let's have a gospel meeting, because there were a number of unsaved ones there, so we had a gospel meeting as well. So anyway, that was a long weekend, but a happy time of fellowship. A couple of months later, in the month of February, actually, we had a conference, our first conference there. Again, a wonderful time of fellowship. The believers worked very hard to bring in a number of unsaved, as well as different ones who have professed to be saved but not gathered out. And Brother Ed Doherty, former missionary to Cuba, was there with us, and a couple other brethren that speak some Spanish from the Phoenix Assembly, and some from the Spanish Assembly in East Los Angeles. That's where we go. They were there as well, and I won't elaborate on that, but just to say it went very, very well. In Los Angeles, we, our home base, as I call it, is the Spanish Assembly in East Los Angeles. When we first arrived there, 1980, there were about 25 that were in Assembly Fellowship. God has blessed since then, and I would say there's between 60 and 70 now in the fellowship, and the Assembly has been very, very encouraging and going on well for the Lord. I want to spend the rest of my time, though, explaining to you where we spend a great deal of our work in an outreach work in the city of Linwood. Linwood is in the metropolitan area of Los Angeles, southeast of central Los Angeles, if you know anything of the area. We started in 1981 in using a doctor's office, and it went very, very well. We started with just a handful coming, and then it continued to grow to a point where we felt like we had to expand, and we was able to get another building. And getting the other building, it was an old motorcycle shop. Somebody had given us some paint, but it wasn't enough paint of one. It wasn't enough paint of one particular color, so we mixed all the paint together and made it kind of a ugly-looking gray color, and that's what we used to paint the floor with. And now we did that every 6 months or so, and we only had to do it twice because it happened that when we closed down for the end of the year holiday, we always closed for about 2 weeks. Came back, Nellie and I did, to check out everything and get everything ready for the next meeting, and we opened the door. It was a total disaster. A gang in the area had broken into the hall and totally devastated it. It was to a point where it was totally unusable. We looked at one another. Big people aren't supposed to cry, but we almost did. And we thought, well, maybe this is the end of the road for us. Maybe the Lord is telling us it's time for us to get out of this area. Not knowing what to do, but praying about it, a number of the young people who have been were helping us in the work came to us and said, listen, if you decide to remodel, we'll put our shoulder to the work. We'll help you as much as we can. And they lived good to their work. On Friday nights, they were there sometimes to midnight, up again early in the morning Saturday, and worked long hours on Saturday. And we did that for a year and a half. We finally were able to remodel that hall. After we modeled the hall, we went into the neighborhood wondering what kind of reception we would have. We started with a series of meetings. By the end of this series, we had over 150 people in from the neighborhood. Now, I'd like to explain at this point a little bit what the neighborhood's like in Linwood. I have a number of articles written from a local newspaper describing the difficulties and the worries that different individuals have and what's going on in that city and surrounding cities. It has the largest crime rates of any city in Los Angeles County. There are more gangs and gang members in that city than any other city. Consequently, there are more deaths. We work among these people that have this type of upbringing, this type of lifestyle. Many of them have come and do come to our meetings. We have mainly teenagers that are coming to the meetings. That is something that we find very interesting, but yet they come faithfully and seem to have a great interest in what is going on. Let me tell you a little bit about different individuals who have come. There was one boy, about 17, 18. He was in the gangs. His name was Pacheco. And it happened that one day, after coming to the meetings for a number of months, he told Nellie and I, he says, I'm going to get out of the gangs. I'm going to get a job. I'm going to get out of my gang clothes. And we'll start living like a normal human being. Well, we thought that was great. Sure enough, he did change. He did get a job. But one day he came to the meeting and we insist that they take their hats off. Let me just a little deviation here. There was a sister who came for the first time, somewhat on a little timid side, and coming into that neighborhood and seeing the work. She had a real desire to be a part of it, but not sure, a little bit uncertain about what had all happened to her. And so she sat down and Nellie, this boy came in and he didn't want to take his hat off. So Nellie said to him, offer your hat. He said, no. He said, yes. Well, finally, she persuaded him to take the hat off. And then she marched him over to this sister who was sitting there, and she said to the sister, this young man has a difficulty keeping his hat off. Now I'm sure that you will help him to do so. So Nellie turned around and walked away, and as soon as she walked away, this boy puts his hat back on. And the sister patted him on the knee quite gingerly and said, Sonny, please take your hat off. And he looked back at her and says, I'll take mine off as soon as you take yours off. And then we had a difficulty trying to explain why she had to have a hat on and he couldn't have his hat on. But anyway, those are some of the things that you encounter in a work like this. Pacheco, we told him he had to take his hat off. He didn't want to. Finally, one of his friends said, show Tom why you don't want you to take your hat off. Reluctantly, he lifted it off. And he had a cut about 6 inches this way, another one about 6 inches this way, and you can see right into his cranial. And what happened is somebody on that afternoon jumped him and his own ex-gang members because he left the gang, and they beat him up quite severely, hitting him on the head twice with a hammer, mangling his arms. And I said to him, I says, listen, Pacheco, I said, you shouldn't be here. You should be in the hospital. And he said, Tom, I wanted to come. And I said, well, that's great, but we're going to have to get you to the hospital. We did, and about 4 o'clock in the morning, well, we got out and said, well, where do we take you? Where do you live? Well, I knew he didn't have a place to live, but I said, where were you living? And he says, well, he says, I just go wherever they keep me. And I said, well, where were you last night? He says, Carlos was there. I said, well, let's go to Carlos. And sure, he dropped off. Mother Carlos' mom wasn't really pleased getting up 4 in the morning, but nevertheless, he didn't have a place to stay. That's a little bit, oh, I was going to say nothing about that, Pacheco. Happened that Pacheco was, a number of months later, he got a phone call. And they said, Tom, Pacheco's been killed. He went over to see what happened, and actually they said he would commit a suicide. Found out later that he was actually killed. He went there, and he didn't have anything other than the gang members got together, and they washed cars. And with the money they had washing cars, they were able to rent a casket, a used casket, rent a suit, and let him have a little funeral. We're the ones that brought some flowers and a little something to eat for the occasion. I'll say that he had absolutely nothing. He ended up being cremated, but it was a very sad, sad experience. A young man who once showed a real interest in the gospel, and as far as we know, he did not leave any indication that he was ever saved. I will say this. We average about 2 young people that come to our meetings per year that either get killed by a drive-by, by stabbing, or some other way. And when you're preaching to young people like this, living in insecure environments, you can only preach your heart out, realizing that you may never, ever see them again. And that has happened over and over again in the years that we have been the people that we have cared for very, very much. We've also had a number of people who have had very close calls in losing their life. One boy, whom we know very well, coming to the meeting, He's come to meetings that I have had in Linwood. He's come to meetings in Culver City that Harold Paisley and I have had. And I've watched that young man literally shake as he sat in a gospel meeting. One day, I brought him through the hall in Linwood. We had our Bibles open and we were reading from Luke chapter 16. And I explained to him what Luke 16 meant. And that whole table in the Bible is just going like this the whole time. I mean, here's a boy, 19 years of age, up to here in the gangs, up to there in the drugs and all the rest of it, and literally shaking like a leaf at the thought of dying without Christ and going to a lost sinner's hell. One day, on the way in the neighborhood, he came to me and said, "Tom, look at my car. The whole back end, the window was blown out," and told me what happened. He said he was came to a stop sign and something on the floorboard of his car on the other side, he wanted to pick it up, and he reached over to pick it up, and just as he did, a bullet came through the back end of the back window, right over the steering wheel where his head was, and out the front. And I said, "Carlos," I said, "this man lets you know you're only a half inch away from hell." He said, "Yeah, I know, Tom. I know." And many other things I can tell you about that boy. He's come so close to death. One thing I will tell you, just recently, he, with a lot of his friends there, he's 21 years old now, and this just happened a couple of months ago, he said to me, and I was dropping off the different people, he had a bunch of his friends there, he says, "So I want everybody to listen to me." He said, "Tom," "everybody, I want all of you to know something. I'm saved. I'm going to heaven." I said, "Carlos, when did you get saved? And how do you know you're saved?" He said, "Tom, you know that time when you and I were together, and I've done this many times. So you were driving, we were driving along the road, and we were going down," he told me the street, Paramount Boulevard. He said, "We were going down Paramount Boulevard. And he says, we came to a certain intersection. He says, you were talking about the gospel and what it meant to be saved and how to get saved. He says, you know, I remember as if I was there right now. At that moment," he says, "that's when I trusted Christ as my own personal Savior." He says, "I know I'm saved." Now, I'll tell you, whether that boy is or not, I don't know. I like to think he is. He has a lot of talent, he has a lot of gift. But he's a boy that has an awful lot to work through as well. And we trust that God will work in his life and really manifest it in a very genuine way. Another incident, another boy named Jesse. Jesse is a boy that's taller than I am. Probably about 24 years old now. He comes to our meetings quite faithfully still. And when he comes, he drives. Well, still, we have a number of people that drive to the meetings, and they don't. Most of them we pick up, but some of them drive their own cars. But anyway, before Jesse drove to the meetings, he would stand out in the front. And the thing that was quite ironic is this, that these boys, teenagers, they would go in about, I pick them up about 6:30. At 6:30, they would go in and were in their bedrooms, and they would take their guns out of their pockets and pick up their Bibles and stand out in the front of their houses and wait for me to pick them up. Now, the reason why they do that is because they found out that Tom doesn't like guns in the meeting. And I had an incident when we had over 150 people in the hall, and somebody came to me and said, "Tom, the so-and-so has a gun." So I went over there, and sure enough, he was standing against the wall, and I grabbed him real quick and spun him around and frisked him and found the gun, extracted it, and he turned around glaring at me, and he says, "You can't do that." And I said, "Well, I just did." And he says, "Well, give me back my gun." And I says, "No." I said, "You're a fool for having a gun in this place." I didn't quite call it down, but he says, "Foolish for you to have a gun in this place." And I said, "You're not going to have it." And I said, "In fact," I says, "you're going to go home. And if you insist on having this gun, I'm calling the cops." And I said, "If you don't sit down and you won't do it, you're going to be in trouble." But finally, he went and he sat down. Well, just as we were finishing up our conversation, the brother who was leading the singing and the praying, he was praying at the time when this all went on, and he was done, and he's making the announcements, and he says, "Now it's time for Brother Baker to give his message." Well, I was just around behind a little wall, this was all going on. I had a gun in my hand, and my name was being announced to go speak, and didn't know what to do, and so all I could do is pretty well put it in my pocket, figured the safest place in the building, and then I had to go up and preach. Well, of course, as I say to people, that was the first time I gave a fully loaded message. But they found out that Tom doesn't like guns in the home. And in fact, just reference to that, we were kidding with a couple of young people who have been saved since, and one of the boys said to me about a month or two ago, he said, "Hey, Tom," he said, "you're fortunate the police didn't make a raid that night in the hall." I said, "Why is that?" He said, "Because you'd have been the only one there with an illegal weapon." And he said, "You'd have marched off to jail." I said, "Well, thank the Lord for those things." But anyway, that's the way things are. Not very often do we have those kind of disturbances, but they do happen. In fact, the different brethren who have shared meetings with me in the past have marveled at how well these individuals will sit and listen. Speaking about having meetings with different brethren, and I'm getting away from my subject with Jesse, but I'll get back to him in a minute. I had a series of meetings with Norman Mellish, and he was there for the first night. We were making arrangements on how we're going to pick up the children. I often sometimes put anywhere between 25 and 30 in our truck. Kenny rides with me, which I'll make a reference to in a minute. Anyway, he was going to come out and shuttle the people back into the hall, the people, and he was having a difficulty finding me. I told him the general area where I was, and finally he saw where I was, and he was in a car that somebody loaned to him that looks just like the cars that the narcotic angels use. And he comes wheeling in right behind me just as I'm getting out at this stop where there's a number of these bigger boys. And one of the boys said to me, "Tom," he says, "duck," he says, "there's a narc behind you. Do you want us to shoot him?" And I said, "this thing." And I told him, "Well, whoever it is, don't shoot." And I looked around. There was Norman Mellish sitting behind the steering wheel. So I said, no. I said, "Don't shoot him." I said, "He's got one of our friends. He's going to preach with you tonight." And I says, "You'll get to know him during this series of meetings." Where, well, everything calmed down. Norman called his wife a couple of nights later, and he says, "Honey, I'll be home at such and such a time. That is, if they don't shoot me first." But anyway, another meeting I had was with David Oliver, and there was this lady there, or this girl, about 20 years of age, big girl, and she was picking a fight with this another girl that's about her same age, but yet not quite as big. Just as that fight was developing, Nellie saw it, and she ran over to what was happening, and she could see that this girl was about ready to crown this other girl with this folding chair. We have metal folding chairs. And she put her arms around this other girl, and she says to the girl that was about ready to hit her, she says, "If you hit her, you're going to hit me first." And the other girl just picks up the chair. She says, "Well, I feel so sorry for you." And about ready to give them both, let them both have. Well, fortunately, David Oliver was in the room, and he saw what was going on just in time, and he just snatched the chair out of the hands of the girl just as it was about ready to come down on top of Nellie and the other girl. So, again, a few incidents, but on the whole, that is not what happens. Jesse, he was standing out there with his Bible along with a number of other people that come to our meetings, and this man went by. He stopped, backed up his car, pulled out a revolver, walked up to Jesse and put it to his head. And he said that he was mad dogging him, if you know what that means, and looking at him in a certain way. And so he put it to his head. Well, Jesse said, and the way they talk is, "What's up?" And he said, the boy said, "I'm going to kill you." And so Jesse said, "Well, whatever." And then the man started looking around, and here all these people were with these Bibles in their hands. So he thought, "Well, something's up." And sure enough, he thought, "Well, this is suspicious." And you could see there was going to be so many witnesses. He decided that he'd get back in his car. When he got back in his car, he's still talking to Jesse, and Jesse just standing there, and started opening fire. Well, as soon as he started opening fire, Jesse took off, and he jumped over this picket fence, and he did a belly flop, as it were, on the other side. And he showed me afterwards that the bullets, there were three of them, went right through the picket fence, and it just, like, skimmed right over the top of his head. And just behind was another boy, about 16, 17, was hurrying, his mother told him to take the laundry off the line before he went to the meeting. He was hurrying, gathering up the laundry, and the three bullets sunk in a car that was right next to him, right there in the, where he's picking up the laundry to come, before he came to the meeting. So that's a little bit of what type of neighborhood it is. There are over 800 that have been killed, young people killed on the streets over there, in a year's time. So it's somewhat of a war zone. In the working there, different ones who are helping us for the most part are young people who have been saved, baptized, and added to the assembly fellowship right out of that work. Different ones who have been helping us that way. And part of those are our own two boys. Our boys have been a real asset to the work. They were to be baptized along with one of their best friends. His name's Leonard Perez. Some of you may know Debbie Perez, and she was saved from the work in Linwood as well. She was in this area for a while. Anyway, they felt that she wanted to be baptized in Linwood, but we didn't know how it was going to go. We have a portable baptistry. Oh, time's gone. I've got to hurry. They have portable baptistry. We had a meeting, and there were over 200, and about 250 from the neighborhood that were out to that meeting. Wonderful time, and just everybody's cramped in there. We thought, my, what is going to happen? But everybody was reverent, and it was a wonderful occasion. From that time, our boys have been received and Leonard as well into the assembly fellowship, and they have been, since then, been a real help. Glenn is doing the singing generally in the evenings, and we were out picking up the ones. We drop them off, and when we drop them off, well, he starts singing, keep them going, and then we go out and pick some more up, and that's the way it goes, and he'll sing and helps us in that special way. Kenny rides with me, and Leonard rides with his mother in her van, and Kenny with me in the back of my truck. Kenny has the job of keeping order amongst the young boys or teenagers that come with us. One day, we pulled into a certain place, and I was out talking to the people, and a boy that used to come, he wasn't coming that night, he used to come, he pulls out of his jacket a gun, he puts it here to Kenny's neck. And I don't really know what the real purpose of it was, but when he saw that I was coming, he finally put it back into his pocket. But those are some of the things I will say. That boy today is doing a lot of time in jail for intent murder that he's doing time for right now and with somebody else. So the potential, of course, is there with these people. I think I better... my time is gone, but could I just spend just a minute or two longer to... you don't mind if I just... okay. Well, I don't want to keep you... I want to say that from that work in Linwood, just these two more things and then I'll finish. From that work in Linwood, we have branched out into two other works. Developed into two more works. One of them is in the city of Norwalk. Norwalk is in the home of a sister who was also saved in the Linwood area. She lived only two blocks from the hall. When we found her, when she first started coming, she lived in a cave. It was an old house. She had one room that she raised her four children in. It was Drug City. To tell you a little bit of what it was like, the man that's in the home and the father, I should say, of the man who fathered the children, when he was growing up, the father was such a heroin addict that he was in desperate need of what they call a fix, didn't have any money, and he took his son's Social Security card and sold it for $20 to get himself a fix. And then later that on, he was in the same situation, and he sold his birth certificate. And a few more important pieces of information. And when we went to try to help the boy or the man to get him a job, get him established and in the workforce, we didn't have any identification. And as far as the U.S. is concerned, he was never born. And that was a difficult thing to work through all of that. But anyway, that gives you an idea of what type of environment this lady was in. She herself was not a drug addict, but involved or around at all. The Lord saved her miraculously. Her life has been transformed in a wonderful way. And not to go into any long details, but the Lord has afforded her, allowed her to have a nice four-bedroom home now in the city of Norwalk. It was her exercise as soon as she got the home to have meetings there. She started to with the exercise for her father and her sisters and, of course, her own children. The Lord was good, and her father and one of her sisters have professed. The other sister is still not saved, but two of her own children have professed as well. From that, the work has developed into a growing thing, because our youngest son, Glenn, was in charge of taking care of her children, and her children brought some of their friends over. And after a week of trying to keep them all quieted, he said, decided, well, he asked us if it was all right for him to have a little Sunday school with the children, little children meetings. So he decided it would be fine. He started with a children meetings, and from that children's little group of children, it has grown to sometimes over 30 that come to the little work there. How it developed once, it was the girl that's the oldest daughter of the home. Her teacher found out about these meetings. He's a professing Christian. He got all excited about it. He let the class know. In fact, he told the class, if you go, you get extra points. He gave the example, and he came, brought his wife, and brought his four children. Well, unbeknownst to him or the rest of us, four of his boys in his class were the worst boys in the class. They decided they would come as well. As he saw them there that night, he couldn't believe it. And Glenn was singing with them, and I was having the Bible study, and he said to me, Tom, says, do you mind? And I said, sure, whatever. And so he gets up, and he walks over to the corner like over there, and he looks around where they couldn't see him. And he looked at those four boys, and they were all singing. Now, they never sang Christian hymns before in their lives, but they didn't know anything about what they were singing, but they were singing, okay? And the man came back, and he said, I can't believe it. He said, I give them a piece of paper to some homework or a test. He said, they'll just look at me. They defy me. He said, he's got them in there singing. And then after a while, something changed, and Glenn was having them do verses. And the time he went over to look around there, here was one of the boys standing up holding the verse that Glenn had them doing. And then Glenn had the lesson. The next day at school, he says, well, some of you went to the Bible study last night. Can anybody tell me what took place? Well, one of the girls that were there, she shot up her hand, and she says, I'll do it. So he's about ready to let her do it when one of the boys, the roughest boys there, said, no, I want to do it. Well, of course, the teacher was very happy to see that, so he let the rough boy come up, and he says, tell us what you heard. And Glenn was on the prodigal son that night. And he told a story. The teacher said he couldn't believe, sat with his mouth open, how well the voice told the story. And after he was done, he said, have you ever heard that story before? He said, nope. And that before last night. He went and sat down. And the teacher was very, very much impressed. Later on, about a month or so later, that same boy was one day with Glenn just alone. His old friends were there and everything. He didn't care. He was just alone. He was asking Glenn, tell me how to get saved. I want to get saved. His mother is into witchcraft. She's a devil worshiper. There's another couple that come, children that come, and their mother is a Buddha worshiper. And we even have a few kids that have Christians for parents that come to that. But I'll tell you another thing about these four boys. One day on the campus, at a school, there was a campus policeman, and she was a lady, and they jumped her. And they beat her up so severely, she had to go home. That happened on, I think it was on Thursday or Friday. Monday night is when we have the meetings in this home. And that lady, who's a professing Christian, she heard about our Bible studies, and she came. And wouldn't you know it, here these four boys were sitting in Glenn's class, and she was sitting in our class. Well, you can imagine how their mouths dropped open when, after the meeting, they saw her sitting there. And then, even to make it more so, one of the boys that jumped her lived only a block or two from her house, and she courageously said, I'll take him home. And we said, are you sure?
She said, yes, I want to take you home. So she took him home and dropped him off. And since then, the teacher says they're looking at her in a totally different light than what they did before. So you might remember that work, it stemmed out from the Linwood work. Let me quickly to just wrap this up. There's another work that's going on in the city of Ontario to travel. We go to have meetings, Bible studies, generally on Wednesdays. It's about an hour from our home, and we go there about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. We start about 3 in the afternoon, have a Bible study to about 6 or 6:30. We leave, and we go to the Spanish Bible study in the evening on Wednesday evening in East Los Angeles. But that has been a very profitable study. It's made up of people who were saved in the Linwood work. It started with a sister, she's 22 years of age now. She was in a wheelchair, and she got saved about the same time, within a week, of the time that this lady that I was telling you about, where we're having the homes in Norwalk, was saved. And then her sister, who is 21 now, professed to be saved. She's married now to an unsaved man. A very, very difficult life. He's a Catholic boy, and she told us, she says, I'm very, very repentant for what I've done, and she's living in the difficulties that that brings, but yet very interested in coming to the Bible studies. Another boy, 17, was that family was saved during a series that Harold Paisley and I had in Culver City. And then the mother, who only speaks Spanish, Nellie, for 2 years, was translating my messages, though I speak Spanish. In those meetings, I only speak English because it's an English work. And she would translate from English to Spanish, and the lady would sit there and she would read these messages. She professed to be saved, and a wonderful, wonderful sister in the Lord. Anyway, and all of that, boy professed to be saved. He's 20 years of age, and he was a leader, one of the great leaders in one of the gangs there in Linwood. And when he got saved, I tell you, that rattled many a person. Well, let me tell you one thing about that boy. He has a real exercise about his family and seeking to win them for the Lord. Oftentimes, he has his brothers out to these meetings, and they have to come as far as we do, a good hour anyway, to the meetings, but oftentimes they are there, and they are showing an interest in the things of God and the salvation of their souls. Approximately a month ago, got a phone call, and it was from this boy, and he says, Tom, I'm in the hospital. Went over to see him, and he looked like he just came out of the war zone, bandages all over his head. I said, call him by name, what happened? He said, well, I was at my father's house, and a group of a gang jumped over the fence and started to steal my father's car. We all went out to try to not let him get away with it, and one of the boys from the gang pulled a gun. For some reason, this young man became his target. He shot a bullet, and the bullet went, and he had his mouth open because it went through the inside of his mouth and out to the other side, the cheek, and then another bullet, as he was falling, went along here, made a furrow just above his ear, and then another bullet made like an X, another furrow right over here on the other side. Then, fortunately, figure must have happened, he put his hand, when the bullet hit his face, he put his hand like this, and a fourth bullet came along and hit his finger, and it just blew his finger apart. And it, fortunately, it was enough to slow the bullet down, and though it penetrated his skin, it didn't penetrate his skull. And, of course, he has to live with this thing about being a hard head all the time. But other than that, we're very thankful that he is alive. Because another bullet, we found out later, went through a 2-inch pipe, went in one side and out the other side. And how it didn't penetrate his skull is something that only God knows. He's very thankful to be alive. We took him to meeting that night in Linwood. He sat there, and I tell you, helped make a solemn meeting as those people watched him, knowing who he was and what he had been through. But God is seeking to use that young man. He has a lot of gift. We're in a Bible study. He comes out of a totally gang-related background.
His father's a drunkard, and his mother has no care for anything, a number of brothers and sisters. And you remember the days when he used to go down and just run a run for drugs for $20 just so he could have a hamburger to eat. He had nothing to eat. And now he's saved and seeking to go on for God, and it's a wonderful thing. But the thing that amazes you is this, is to see this young man, with his, ability to speak about the Word of God. He really has a way of explaining things when we were in our studies together in the home. So you might pray for them and pray for that study and the different aspects of the work that we are seeking to carry on with God's help and His will. So there's many other things I'm sure I could